From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Facing accusations of sexual harassment by former staffers, 88-year-old Michigan Democrat John Conyers went on a Detroit radio show today from the hospital where he's convalescing to announce he's leaving Congress.
I am retiring today, and I want everyone to know how much I appreciate the support, the incredible, undiminished support I've received across the years from my supporters, not only in my district, but across the country as well.
Conyers, the longest-serving member of the House, denies the accusations against him, as does Alabama Senate candidate Roy Moore, who returns to campaigning with the backing of the Republican National Committee, which has reinstated its support for him despite the sexual misconduct accusations against him. Jessica Taylor, NPR politics reporter, is here with an update on some of the stories we've been following. And Jessica, Conyers sounded shaky, and it wasn't clear if he meant resign immediately or retire at the end of the term? What do we know? What happens with his seat?
Yeah, this was a bit confusing because he did keep saying retire, but we have confirmed that he does mean that he is resigning immediately, and that would trigger the governor to appoint a special election for his seat. And this could get, you know, kind of messy as well there. There's a lot of Detroit politics going on there. He has said that he said in that interview that he wants his son, John Conyers III, to succeed him. His grandnephew has also said he's interested in running for the seat. So this is going to be, I think, a very messy Democratic primary. And, you know, just the fact of how long this went on. Like you said, he was the longest serving member of the House, and we'd seen Democratic lawmakers want to stand behind him. You know, just a week ago, Nancy Pelosi was saying, you know, how he was, you know, this an icon and everything too. But as more and more of these stories came out, it's clear that his health is failing as well. I think that probably played a part in it as well. But that the pressure, I think, was eventually too much for him.
Right. Well, to Roy Moore, yesterday the RNC resumed its support for him after President Trump endorsed him. Republicans are divided, though. Former presidential candidate Mitt Romney said a Moore victory next week and that a special election would be a stain on the GOP and on the nation. So how much will this RNC support impact the election? And is it even about the election, or maybe positioning the party for what happens after the election?
I think what it is it's a clear signal that this is President Trump's Republican Party now. And this came after President Trump tweeted out his really unequivocal support for Moore. He'd sort of given him cover in recent days, sort of hedging a little bit, saying, you know, well, he says these aren't true and we really don't want to elect a liberal, a Democrat, Doug Jones, his opponent in there too. But he came out Monday, said very forcefully, I am endorsing him, called him, and is now fully behind him. And I think this is because I think the president sees a lot of himself in Roy Moore, because if you remember back during the campaign, he had multiple women that came out accusing him of sexual assault. He has had to he has denied those allegations and everything, too. But he sees someone, I think, as being unfairly accused. But this is obviously an issue that is very much dividing the Republican Party. And it's a very risky step for them to take. But I do think that, again, this is a close race, even with these allegations, because Alabama is so red. Mm. And this certainly has the potential to sort of divide the Republican Party even further than we saw it divided in the 2016 campaign and beyond.
I want to make sure we get to news today from the Palestinian press, which is reporting that President Trump today called Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and told him he intends to move the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. And in a speech tomorrow, Trump may declare Jerusalem the capital of Israel. Of course, Palestinians are outraged. They had hoped East Jerusalem would someday be, you know, the capital of their separate country. Turkey, the EU, have all warned the U.S. against this, especially when the president is trying to negotiate a Middle East peace deal. Your thoughts on this?
I mean, this is something that President Trump talked a lot about during the campaign, that he really wanted to do was to name Jerusalem the capital. And so this is a campaign promise that he has said that he would keep. I think this is something that is important to a lot of his, you know, evangelical supporters, too, and Jewish supporters. So I think it's something that certainly it sort of adds a little bit of uncertainty to sort of an already tenuous, you know, obviously peace there at a time when there's obviously a lot going on elsewhere in the world with a lot of instability. So it comes at a very interesting time for sure. But this is something that he's talked about for during the campaign as well.
We're also learning that congressional leaders and President Trump aren't going to sit down to negotiate a way out of the government shutdown. We're facing that deadline until Thursday. And this is the day before the government funding expires. And Republican leaders are saying no way to Democrats and at least one Republican we've spoken with who insists that any deal on the budget and funding the government also include, you know, resolving the Dreamers. These are the young people brought illegally as children, resolving their future. Is that possible? Because Republicans need Democratic votes to pass a short-term spending plan.
It's certainly an impasse that we're not really sure what is going to happen, because you're right. And you have some more moderate Republicans that really want this addressed as well. And, you know, President Trump has sort of given conflicting answers to whether he wants this addressed to, you know, when he said that he was going to pull back what President Obama did. He did sort of sound, I think, regretful about some of this. So it's an impasse. And of course, it's coming up against the holidays, you know, and the more sort of conservative Freedom Caucus. They want to push the deadline because they are worried that if it's this December 22nd deadline with people wanting to go home for the holidays, that they are more likely to bend to Democrats and to maybe more moderate members of trying to put these things in there, too. So we always sort of seem to come down to this right around the holidays.
Yeah. This is not new. We will probably kick it down the road. Jessica Taylor, politics reporter for NPR, with, thank you, a wrap-up of some of the things we're keeping an eye on. Thanks, Jessica.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, it's been about 3 months since Hurricane Harvey hit Houston, and in the neighborhood of Meyerland, many houses are still vacant, and the neighborhood is eerily silent. Meyerland used to be a lively place with busy sidewalks and kids riding bikes. Houston Public Media's Davis Land reports on a community in transition.
It's 7 o'clock, the sun is set, the streetlights are on. Some of the houses are well lit, but there aren't any cars. I'm in the middle of Houston, and it feels a little weird.
So we're about to enter the war zone. This is one block away from the bayou. As you can see down there, it's really dark. There's nobody there.
That's Lynn Korn. Like a lot of people in Maryland, her house flooded during Harvey. Since then, it's become kind of eerie out here. No one around.
So, vacant house. Vacant house. That's obviously vacant, even though they have a big light on in the front. This one's vacant also. This entire cul-de-sac is vacant, I believe.
Korn is out here walking her dog, Kirby. She's one of the few people on the street, which is unusual, considering Maryland is normally a pretty lively place.
At night, it was sort of at dusk, it was really, really busy on the sidewalk. Lots of people are out riding bikes. There's a gentleman that rides around. He's got a reclining bike, and he's always riding around saying hi to everybody.
Kids out playing, like, basketball.
Yeah, absolutely.
We have a remnant of that community left. It's quite a significant change in terms of you see people, and it's great to see them. They're few and far between, so you're like, well, you're kind of excited to see them. You're like, hey, I know you.
That's Gil Melman. Gil and his wife, Samantha, rebuilt their house after the Memorial Day flood in 2015.
I mean, I remember it very vividly. We woke up at 3 o'clock in the morning to flood water. We were not prepared or expecting it like our neighbors were. We woke up, and at 3:01, I had already made the decision. Didn't tell my wife, but already made the decision that I wasn't going to go through this again, and I was going to probably either build or get out.
The Melmans rebuilt, raising the house about 5 feet in the process. Gil tells me that anyone who's still in the neighborhood did the same thing.
How many of the houses that we can kind of see just from your doorstep do you think are vacant right now?
These three right here, and then all of these, if you go, every house that is built on grade, so all of the older homes are all vacant. And then you have one that was raised, new construction, raised.
So every single house out here that has cars in the driveway, they're all raised houses.
That's right.
If you rebuild your home in Houston's Meyerland area, rather than just repair or move, you're replacing probably a 60-year-old house on ground level with a new home raised a few feet off the ground. In the long run, that will add value to the area, so even though Meyerland is dark and empty right now, odds are good it'll be back to its former glory soon. Jocelyn Geit has lived in Meyerland for 7 years. She says these lulls have become kind of common.
I mean, right now, it's nothing like it normally is. But we've lived through this other flood where I saw it have the same dynamic where everyone disappeared. It got quiet. It looked devastated. But then it came back. Everyone moved back in. We got right back to life. And so I know what this looks like, and I know how it happens. And I can see it's going to happen again. Mm-hmm. Most people want to go back. But we've decided not to go back.
Geit and her family flooded once before, rebuilt, and didn't think it would happen again. Then Harvey hit.
And it just, at that point, I think it hit me that I don't have that much time left in this chapter with our kids home. And I think the idea of building a house and taking another 18 months to 2 years before we even come back, and then we only have our kids at home for maybe even a couple more years after that, it just became really clear that we're not up for that.
Right now, Geit and her family are in an apartment, and they plan to move to a different neighborhood in Houston. They're in this in-between state that a lot of families flooded by Harvey are in. Geit put it this way, they all have the responsibility of figuring out where to live, but the storm has made that decision for them. For Here and Now, I'm Davis Land in Houston.
It's been almost 10 years since the global financial crisis, which caused a deep recession in this country and had ripple effects around the world. One of the worst hit countries was Greece, which had an unsustainable amount of debt and had to be rescued multiple times by international lenders. There were fears that a Greek collapse would bring down the entire euro currency and perhaps destroy the European Union. That hasn't happened yet. One of the people at the center of the storm was Yanis Varoufakis, who was Greece's finance minister at the height of the crisis. He's written a new book called Adults in the Room, My Battle with the European and American Deep Establishment. He joins us from Athens. Welcome.
Well, it's very, very, very good to be on your program. Thank you.
Well, and as we're speaking with you in 2017, the Greek debt crisis is ongoing. There are some signs of improvement, but how would you describe the current state of Greece's economy?
Well, Greece and its people are caught up in, or incarcerated, I should say, in a permanent debtor's prison. In 2010, our state went bankrupt and we pretended that that didn't happen at the behest of international creditors who lent us a large wad of money in order to extend the crisis into the future, pretending that we solved it.
So what should have happened?
Well, what happened to General Motors, to put it in an American context? When in 2009 General Motors was bust, there were two options. Close it down and then write off all the debt, or give it a debt restructure. And you will recall that under the Obama administration, General Motors got a 90% write-down of its debt, then restructure the company and then move on. So that's precisely what should have happened with Greece. We should have restructured our debts, restructured our state and our, if you want, society more generally, and then take the pain of this restructuring, of this bankruptcy effectively, and then start building up again.
Wouldn't it have been others, though, that were taking a lot of that pain, your lenders?
Well, for every irresponsible borrower, as they say, there is an irresponsible lender. If you didn't have this kind of pain shared between debtors and lenders, capitalism would be defunct. Because if the lenders do not take any pain, then why should any lender ever be responsible in the way they lend money? And then, of course, if lenders are not responsible the way they lend money, you end up with lots of 2008 events.
There were a lot of people all along the way when people like you were talking about bankruptcy or debt restructuring who were saying the consequences of that would have also been severe. There would have been terrible consequences. And if Greece had, let's say, left the euro in the middle of all this, the Grexit option, that would have been a disaster for Greece and for Europe.
Indeed, if Greece had left the eurozone would have collapsed and Greece would have been in a serious mess. I never proposed that Greece should leave the eurozone. But allow me to also say that when you have a large currency union like the European Union, or indeed the dollar zone, also known as the United States of America, if any bankruptcy of, let's say, California or Detroit or General Motors for that matter, if that could not be absorbed by the United States of America, I suggest to you that the United States of America would have collapsed a long time ago. The longevity of any economic bloc depends on its capacity to absorb bankruptcies, because let's face it, bankruptcies are a part of life in capitalism. They are to capitalism that which hell is to Christianity. very unpleasant, but absolutely essential. The whole thing doesn't work without bankruptcies. So if every time there is a bankruptcy, you pretend it didn't happen by giving huge loans to the bankrupt, extending this into the future on the basis of the argument that have you not done so, there's going to be pain, that is a sure way of maximizing the pain, pushing it into the future, and making sure that the bankruptcy's pain is so fierce when it actually is realized and when the pretense ends, that the overall costs will be much, much greater. This is exactly what's happening with Greece today.
What do you think should happen now? Here we are. Greece is probably not going to leave the euro at this point and probably not going to declare bankruptcy anymore.
Oh, it certainly will declare bankruptcy. There is no doubt that when you're bankrupt, at some point, the bankruptcy becomes clear. An unpayable debt does not get paid, period. Especially when you have extending and pretending. So, in answer to your question, what should happen now? Well, what we should have done 7 years ago. We should simply sit down and do what adults do. Face up to the bankruptcy, restructure the debt, have a fiscal policy which is manageable, and then proceed with changes to the Greek society that most Greeks want. The vast majority of Greeks want reforms in Greece, but reforms that actually work. They are prepared to make sacrifices. The problem with sacrifices is that they've been making sacrifices for 7 years now. These were sacrifices that were thrown into a bottomless pit and did not bring about any improvement for anyone.
Doesn't there have to be some sort of moral hazard, though, to stop countries from getting into the kind of debt in the first place that Greece did? How do you deal with that issue?
Well, history has already dealt with this issue. If you think there is anyone around the world who would be silly enough to do which the Greeks did, think about it. Greece has lost 28% of its nominal GDP. This is worse than what happened in the United States in the 1930s. This is the grapes of wrath. Nobody would look at a debt restructure for the Greeks now as a reward for the lazy, the corrupt, and the profligate. Greece has had its huge, gigantic punishment. All I'm saying is that this punishment must end.
You start your book with a conversation in Washington. This is in 2015 when you were the finance minister, and you were talking with Larry Summers, the former Treasury Secretary, and he asks you if you want to be an insider or an outsider. First of all, what do you think that he meant by that, and how did you answer?
Well, let me preface my answer by saying that, because the context is important, this was a meeting between allies. Larry Summers, to his great credit, from my perspective, met me, and we had many exchanges during that period. So in that conversation, in order to suss out what kind of a person I am, he asked me whether I'm an insider or outsider. And in a sense, what he was asking was, can you be trusted? Insiders get to share information amongst each other, but they do not spill the beans, so they don't tell the outsiders what's happening on the inside. And you never turn against insider, even if you disagree with them. And my response was, I will do whatever it takes to get Greece out of debtor's prison. And if I have to pretend that I'm an insider, I will. But the moment I see that the insiders are conspiring to keep Greece and the people of Greece inside debtor's prison, I'm outside, which is exactly what happened. This is why I'm talking to you now, and I'm not in government anymore.
I want to ask you about some of the bigger picture issues that are going on in Europe right now, because after you were finance minister in Greece, we've seen the Brexit vote. We've also seen the referendum in Catalonia, in Spain. What do you make of what's going on in Europe? And do you think that it will be able to hold together given all of these pushes for independence around the continent?
Since 2010, I've been shouting from the rooftops, so to speak, that what we are experiencing throughout Europe is the after effects, the symptoms of a European economic architecture which was never designed to sustain the shockwaves of the collapse of Wall Street in 2008. As for Brexit, which you mentioned, if Greece was not treated with the contempt that we were treated in 2015 and our people was not crushed the way we were, I don't believe that Brexit would have taken place. Let me remind you that Brexit won with 1.8%. I can assure you that at least 2% of those who voted for Brexit did so because they were appalled by the way that Greek democracy was crushed. And I had thousands of people who came up to me and they said, look, we hear what you say, you're inviting us to stay in the European Union, but we're not going to do this. We're not going to vote to remain after the way your government was treated.
I want to ask you one more thing while we have you, something that's going on in this country. As you know, the Senate just passed this massive tax overhaul in this country that many people believe is really just a benefit for corporations and the wealthy and will not help the middle class. What do you make of this tax overhaul debate going on in the U.S. right now?
I'm particularly saddened by the low quality of the debate, and in particular, I'm saddened and angered by this monstrously irresponsible tax bill. What Mr. Trump and the Republicans are doing is they're jeopardizing the stability of the United States of America for the next 20 years. What you're doing in your country, if you allow me to say, not you, but your government, is that you are boosting the federal budget on behalf of the top 0.1%, not even the 1%, in a manner that will have absolutely no trickle-down effect. It will have more of a trickle-up effect, boosting your deficit while at the same time antagonizing the one country that owns a third of your debt, and that is China, and creating circumstances of a trade war, which, if successful, is going to make your government's borrowing costs go through the roof at a time when its borrowing needs go through the roof. Today's Washington, D.C. is going to be looked upon by the historians of the future as the worst combination of inanity and evil.
Really?
I think so.
That's Yanis Varoufakis, the former Greek finance minister. His new book is called Adults in the Room, My Battle with the European and American Deep Establishment. Yanis Varoufakis, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It was my great pleasure.
And we'll link you to the book, and you can leave your thoughts at hereandnow.org.
Forget data breaches and identity theft. The real online threat this holiday season may be Grinch bots, people using online bots to buy out the most popular toys of the season, forcing desperate parents, grandparents, aunts to search for LOL surprise dials or the Super Nintendo Classic Edition at Amazon and eBay. Look at this. BuzzFeed News found LOL surprise dials. They usually sell for $9.99, out of stock at Toys R Us and Target, but at Amazon for $372, on eBay for as much as $17,000. Ali Velshi is MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. He's also co-host of Velshi and Rule. Ali, this is insane.
Yeah, it is. And the first word of warning is just be smart about things. There's nobody who should be paying
$17,000.
Yeah, I mean, that's just dumb, right? If anybody's going to pay $17,000 for a doll, we can't help you. But this is a real problem that many people first encountered when it came to concert or Broadway ticket sales, where you could just regular people could never buy them at face value. Things like Hamilton or big concerts, and the idea that it was bots, scalpers using algorithms to buy up all the tickets in the first place and then sell them either via a third-party vendor or independently to people. And this has now moved its way into the hot holiday toy sales industry.
Well, we understand they use the sophisticated software. They guess a product ID. They locate the product page, and they're there right as soon as the product is available.
Correct.
So you have no hope. Look, we thought there were laws against this kind of thing. This came to our attention because Senator Chuck Schumer of New York issued a statement saying Grinch bots can't be allowed
to steal Christmas.
But didn't he pass a law about other tickets?
About bots, right. In 2016, he passed a law that made it easier for consumers to buy concert tickets or theater tickets at face value when they go on sale. It's still not a given. It's still not easy, but it's easier. There are limitations now on what what these bots and algorithms can do. So he has called for this act to expand into children's toys. There's zero chance of it happening for this holiday season. Mm-hmm. But he's also called on the National Retail Federation and the Retail Industry Leaders Association to do what they can to block the bots while he looks at expanding his legislation that would, you know, prohibit the use of bots on things beyond show tickets. But we are, you know, things called fingerlings sell for $15 at Target and Walmart, $200 on Amazon's at the 1300% markup on eBay. $5,000. You talked about Nintendo NES Classic Edition. It's $80 normally, selling on Amazon for $486. Now, again, on eBay for $11,000. But, you know, eBay, everybody tries their luck, right? The one person who really wants it might pay that. Generally speaking, those aren't the real prices. But definitely hundreds of percent markups over retail is what we're seeing on the most popular toys.
Unbelievable. The fingerlings are those little things you wear on your fingers,
yes.
Those little tiny weird things. Look, what can we do to protect ourselves?
Well, they can't be made illegal just yet, so we're hoping that the retailers will do something about it. But consumers, first of all, you can try to buy things in stores. You can, you know, talk to the manager and sort of say, when is this coming in stock? The problem is these bots find out things are popular before people do themselves. Mm-hmm. So by the time you've decided this is all the rage because you've heard about it from your kids' friends or from someone else, it's hard to do. So at least know what the actual retail price is and be able to make a complaint to the retailer to say, how come I can't buy any of these? If they hear from enough people, they may say, hey, we've got to take action. One thing, be wary of counterfeit toys.
Excellent. Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor, economics correspondent. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
In his first interview since President Trump took office, former TV host Billy Bush appeared last night on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. He wanted to talk about the now infamous Access Hollywood tape after recent reports that President Trump denied it was his voice on that tape. Bush said, yes, it was Trump. He told Colbert the denial infuriated him and that it hurts the women who came forward with their allegations of sexual misconduct by the president.
You're reopening wounds on them, too. Enough's enough. Stop playing around with people's lives. That upset me. So I wrote.
Well, Billy Bush was fired from his job on NBC's Today Show last year after the tape was released. He wrote about his experience in the New York Times, and some say he's now hoping for a comeback. This comes as several men of power have lost their jobs in recent weeks after claims of sexual misconduct surfaced against them, including some executives at NPR. But America is the land of the second, third, and fourth chance. So is it possible for any of these people to make a comeback? And if so, what does that take? Joining us now with his thoughts is Lou Shapiro, a criminal defense attorney who specializes in crisis management in Los Angeles. Lou Shapiro, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. Good to be here with you.
And let's start with Matt Lauer, the former host of NBC's Today Show. He was fired last week. Multiple women have made sexual misconduct claims against him. Does he have a chance of coming back?
I think of all people at this point, he probably has the least likely chance of coming back. And that's because in his situation, the allegations are bordering on rape. I mean, you have somebody who claims that they were basically locked in a room and forced to engage in a sexual act with him, and then ended up being passed out in the end. It doesn't read well for him, and he has not issued any kind of statement where he disputes the allegation, merely just an apology, and an apology against these kinds of allegations is not worth that much in the public.
What about Charlie Rose, who was fired from CBS and PBS?
So Charlie Rose, he may have had an opportunity to come back because in his situation, it didn't get to the point where we had the previous person we spoke on, Matt Lauer, but we had a situation where he's acting very inappropriately, immorally. It's almost where you can maybe get treatment for that, but because he's towards the end of his career already, age-wise, he'd have to lay low for at least a few years to make that slow comeback, and he just doesn't have those years to do that.
So how many years do you think somebody needs to make a comeback?
Well, while of course there's no exact formula, obviously the worse the allegations are, the longer it takes to come back. So in a case like Charlie Rose, he probably would have been able to make a turnaround maybe in 2-3 years. on the conservative side.
Now, interestingly, you say that Harvey Weinstein might get a second chance in Hollywood, really?
Well, here's why, yes. And that's because Harvey Weinstein is not front and center like Matt Lauer and Charlie Rose are. He's a guy that pulls strings from the background. And he's on the younger side, and he is a proven talent in the industry. He knows how to pick winners, right? So there are going to be people in the industry that after a couple years, you know, will look for that opportunity, will look to connect with somebody like that. There'll be someone trying to make it, and they'll see him as, you know what? He's someone that can maybe help me, and I can work with him. It's like getting something on sale, you know? And there is that chance that he will make a comeback again behind the scenes.
And how long do you think it would take?
Probably three years on the safe side.
Let's look back at some recent history and some people who've come back from scandal. Now, obviously, not all of these issues, not all of these allegations are the same, but let's take a look at two, starting with Tiger Woods, who had multiple affairs and later apologized to the public. Here he is in 2010.
Every one of you has good reason to be critical of me. I want to say to each of you, simply and directly, I am deeply sorry for my irresponsible and selfish behavior I engaged in.
Now, Tiger Woods and his wife divorced soon after that, and 7 years later, Woods is still there on the professional golf circuit today. How did he do it?
So the way he was able to do it was because what he did, that was not a violation of any type of law. He's a guy who crossed the line into infidelity, which many people do, and that's just the reality of it. So he came out with an apology, didn't violate any laws, so that's why he was able to make that turnaround comeback.
Do you think he remains tarnished, however?
Yeah. I mean, he's never the same. I mean, look at Kobe Bryant also. I mean, he's probably one of the most beloved sports stars, right, these days, and yet he was charged or at least accused of a rape. How did he make that comeback? You know, so the athletes do tend to have an easier time making a comeback than celebrities or people in corporate environments, because people love a winner. People root for them their whole lives, and it's hard for them to stop rooting for them when they engage in a crossroad in their life that's not very favorable to them.
You also have the former late night host David Letterman, who apologized on his show in 2009 after it was revealed that he had an affair with his assistant. He came forward after he said someone tried to blackmail him. And a few years later, he spoke with Oprah Winfrey. Here he is.
I still think if you're going to have a flow chart of the responsibility for this circumstance, this sex scandal,
yes,
my name's at the top.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what it means. But I'm taking responsibility for it. I'm trying to atone for it. And in atoning for it, you eliminate that behavior and apologize to the people you hurt. Going forward, there's not much more you can do.
I can't help but think of how that scandal would have played in today's environment. But in fact, today, David Letterman still married to his wife and was just awarded the Mark Twain Prize for American Humor. What do you make of how he managed to skate by what happened?
So two things. Number one, he came out and issued a genuine apology for a situation where he may not owe an apology to the public, right? This is a personal matter between him and his wife, where there was an alleged affair. He doesn't have to explain that to his listeners and viewers. That is that is arguably a private matter, right? So the fact that he was able to, you know, garner the courage to take it, reveal to the public, apologize to the public, and went above and beyond what people would expect, that earned a lot of points for him. He was able to make that turnaround.
So who do you think in this current environment, other than Charlie Rose, who you've already mentioned, would not be able to make a comeback?
Kevin Spacey, for example. Here you have somebody who is front and center, who is accused of basically sexually molesting a minor. Society has very little patience or tolerance for someone who takes advantage of the youth. That's definitely a line that he crossed.
Although Roy Moore may well win his race in Alabama next week.
Right. So the difference between those two is Roy Moore has not admitted to it. He is defiant that this is all political, made up nonsense. And there is motive to lie on the, you know, victim's part if in fact she is, you know, a liberal, you know, for example, or if she's being put up by the Democratic Party. I mean, he has arguments to say, you know, why this is a lie. Whether they're true or not remains to be seen. Kevin Spacey, on the other hand, he did not deny it. He tried to say maybe it happened. If it did happen, I don't remember it so well, or I apologize. But it wasn't an outright denial of the situation like Moore's coming from. So that's the distinction between the two.
So would you have advised Kevin Spacey to just deny it then, that he would have been able to maybe keep his job if he had simply denied the allegations?
Well, it depends. You know, that's an ethical question for who's representing him. Some people see their job as a representative of someone like Spacey to be like, listen, we just have to deny it at all costs. We need to worry about your career and not worry about our credibility necessarily. That's an approach. And some people are brazen and will take that approach. And they'll justify it by saying, listen, you know, the burden of proof is on the accuser. That's how it is in criminal court. And that's how we're going to play it in the court of the public eye. So until there's evidence to back that up, to corroborate this allegation, we're not going to justify it or give it credibility or dignify it, so to speak.
That's Lou Shapiro, who's a criminal defense attorney who specializes in crisis management in Los Angeles. Lou, thanks for joining us.
You got it.
And you're listening to Here and Now. The holiday season is here. We've all got a lot to do. Dinner may be something that gets knocked pretty far down the list, but never fear. Our resident chef, Kathy Gunst, is here with some suggestions for easy and healthy meals.
And we are inhaling them.
Hi,
Kathy.
There.
Hi. Start with the healthy part of this, because this time of year is when I start mainlining, you know, eggnog and Linzer cookies.
Yeah, and you are not alone. I mean, we are going to parties and dropping by neighbors' homes, and there's trees to decorate and menorahs.
Or just sitting alone in your kitchen and eating Linzer cookies.
There's that also. But, I mean, usually what you're surrounded by are cheese platters and dips and chocolate. So the idea here is that these are three very quick meals with an emphasis on health, but always an emphasis on color and texture and flavor. So we'll start with the healthy rice bowl. I use brown rice because I love the nutty grain of it. If you're in a rush, you could go with white rice. I sauteed winter spinach. You could use Swiss chard or kale and some olive oil with some garlic. Mm-hmm. I surrounded the brown rice with the hot spinach, and then I poached an egg, which is something that seems to put the fear of God into people. Let me tell you what that means. I boiled a pot of water. I cracked an egg into it. I did not touch it for 3 minutes.
Exactly 3 minutes.
Mm-hmm. I took a slotted spoon. I removed it from the water. Yes, you can see it's perfect.
And this is easy? You would call this an easy meal to make?
Would you?
Yeah.
I don't know. Poaching the egg, it does sound
3 minutes, Jeremy.
You just drop it in the water.
Let's rewind. Boil water, drop egg in three minutes. Make some rice, saute some spinach. And then again, for texture and color, I sprinkled the top with pumpkin seeds, sort of a seasonal touch. You could use walnuts. You could use pine nuts, pistachios. It's got color and texture and super good for you. And then you can eat that whole plate of Christmas cookies.
It is
cookies. Delicious,
too.
So good. Okay.
You've also got a dish here with chicken and fruit.
I do. And that, I wasn't going to tell this story, but I think I will, because it will ring true for so many people. I was thinking, okay, quick, easy, here and now, listeners. I opened my freezer. There were some chicken thighs. Okay, perfect. Got those. Then I saw that I had a sweet potato and some carrots from the farmer's market, and I also had some tangerines. Okay, quick, Kathy, think. So I took the chicken thighs, I put some yogurt on them, cumin, cilantro, and oregano and thyme. I cut the carrot and the sweet potato into small pieces. I roasted it at high temperature. Then I sprinkled some walnuts and tangerines on it. And isn't it so yummy?
You also have cilantro on there.
I do. I have fresh cilantro.
So delicious. And so the carrots are so sweet. Is that just the sugar coming up, or did you put a glaze?
No, nothing. It's just their from the farmer's market, so they probably came out of the ground in someone's not totally frozen land within the last week or two.
Yeah.
So the last thing that you have here, and by the way, our listeners can go to hereandnow.org to see your recipes and see some photos. The last thing you have is something I would definitely say is a nice, easy, quick thing to do, or at least quicker than others, which is pizza.
Pizza, particularly if you have a great resource for pizza dough. And that could mean buying it frozen in your grocery store. It could also mean going to your favorite pizza parlor. Do we still call them parlors?
Yeah, we do.
And say, hey, can I buy just two rounds of dough for you? And often they make tons. They have extra. You could use whole wheat, again, playing up, or whole grain, I find in the supermarket.
Wait, I'm sorry. Sometimes these things fly by and my mouth is full. You can just go to your pizza place and ask them to buy some of their dough?
Wait, you mean you can't think when you're chewing? Is that what you just said? Yes, of course. You can say, hey, I only need a pound of pizza dough. Can you just sell me two?
Robin needs pizza training, clearly.
I do.
And she needs to chew and then think. Okay, so no more eating on air, right? Anyway, you can use whole grain or whole wheat pizza or white pizza dough. I used beautiful shiitake mushrooms, portobello mushrooms, sauteed them with garlic and olive oil, and I added fresh ricotta cheese.
This is really good,
by the way.
And the dough is very, very good.
That came from my supermarket, Portland Pizza Company.
Wow. So what else? I mean, just to have on hand, we always have this conversation in the summer, maybe pesto and sun-dried tomatoes. What should you just have in the pantry for a quick dinner?
You know, honestly, if you want to really pay attention to this during this very tough holiday season, have a lot of vegetables around. Have carrots. Have winter squash. Polenta is a great way to go. It's just cornmeal, and you just add boiling water, and it's so comforting. Mushrooms are also great. A lot of fruit. You know, things that you think, well, I'm not going to really eat that because we're going to a holiday party. Actually, you will. And if you do have the right foods in the pantry, in the refrigerator, you're going to tend to eat a little bit better this time of year when everybody eats pretty not very well.
Quick tip on the roasting. I mean, do you literally mean put it in a roasting pan when you talked about the carrots and the...
Absolutely. I put the chicken, the sweet potatoes, and the carrots all in a sheet pan. It was one dish, the whole meal in one dish. Quick, easy, and really bright colors and good flavors.
And how many days in this month do you think you're going to be able to even have the time to make a quick dinner?
You're asking me, the person that needs to cook every day, or they feel lost, and as the world spins out of control, it's the only thing that grounds me. So probably a lot more than you will. Yes. So a lot.
That's true. Here Now resident chef Kathy Gunst will have all her recipes delicious at hereandnow.org. So simple. Kathy, thanks as always.
Kathy. Thanks, guys.
And now Jeremy and I are going to go and crack eggs
and
into boiling water.
Pizza.
And eat. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.